Hey everyone, and welcome back for another Deep Dives. Today we're going to be tackling not one, but TWO legal battles. Both called Davis v. Davis.
Yeah, you heard that right. Two cases with the same name.
But they seem totally different.
Right.
One's about frozen embryos, the other's a beach house brawl.
But trust me, there's a common thread here.
Okay, I'm intrigued.
They both deal with how the law approaches personal autonomy, especially as, you know, technology changes and our values change over time.
Buckle up, everyone. This is going to get interesting.
It really highlights how courts have to do these legal gymnastics to try to apply old frameworks to these new, like, totally weird situations.
I mean, these cases offer a glimpse into how those decisions can have, like, a ripple effect.
Yeah.
Impacting everything from family law to property rights.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's unpack the first Davis v. Davis, the one from 1992 that deals with those frozen embryos.
Okay.
So we're in Tennessee.
Right.
A divorcing couple, Junior and Mary Sue Davis, are at odds over what happens to, wait for it, 7 frozen embryos.
7.
Junior wants them destroyed. Mary Sue initially wants to use them to have a kid, but that changes later.
Wow.
Talk about a high-stakes custody battle, but for embryos.
It really pushes the boundaries of existing legal concepts. I mean, yeah. Trial court declared the embryos human beings, which is like a huge E statement, right?
Right. But like, isn't granting embryos special respect without full personhood kind of like a slippery slope?
Right.
Where do we even draw the line then?
Yeah, that's the question that was on everyone's mind. The Tennessee Supreme Court actually stepped in and said, hold on, not so fast.
Rero.
They created this whole new legal category for embryos, saying that they deserve special respect because of their potential for life, but stop short of full personhood.
That's wild. Imagine trying to get those embryos a passport. So they're not human beings. They're not just property either. Yeah. It's this weird in-between.
Yeah.
What did that mean for how the courts actually handled the case?
So in this case, the Supreme Court sided with Junior Davis's right to not be a parent, even if it meant those embryos wouldn't be used at all.
Wow. So even though by this point, Mary Sue had remarried and wanted to donate the embryos.
Yes.
The court was like, nope. Junior's right not to procreate trumps everything else.
Pretty much.
That's a huge precedent for anyone going through IVF these days.
Absolutely. This idea of procreational autonomy, your right to choose whether or not to have a child, that's gained even more traction today.
Right.
Especially with debates over things like genetic editing and posthumous reproduction.
Yeah.
Davis v. Davis really laid the groundwork for a lot of those really complex ethical questions we're facing right now. Those detailed consent forms you sign at fertility clinics.
Yeah.
They're crucial, folks.
Okay, so we've gone deep on frozen embryos and legal limbo. But speaking of competing interests, the property case really dives into that head first. It's amazing how courts apply similar logic, whether it's embryos or beach houses.
Yeah.
This time it's North Carolina and a family feud over, of all things, a beachfront property.
Oh, yes. The beach house battle royale. This one all boils down to a life estate with a twist.
Okay.
So picture this. Mrs. Davis owns this house, but she sets it up so that she gets to live there for the rest of her life.
Okay. That's the life estate part.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And then her kids inherit it after she's gone. Seems pretty straightforward, right?
Yeah, seems pretty standard, but I bet there's a but coming.
Oh, there's a big but coming.
Okay, lay it on me.
Mrs. Davis tries to restrict her kids from renting out the place while she's still alive.
Oh, wow.
So they're understandably upset.
Yeah, I mean, owning a share of a beach house that you can't even rent out, what's the point?
Right.
Okay, so they take her to court.
Uh-huh.
But if she had a life estate, shouldn't she have at least some control over what happens to the property? Help me understand this.
Right. So that's where it gets a little tricky. Life estates, you see, they come in different flavors.
Mm.
This one, I suspect, was a typical life estate, meaning she had full control during her life, but couldn't say what happens to it after she passes.
Okay. So there are exceptions.
Oh, of course.
Like historical preservation easements or something.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
But Davis v. Davis shows that courts are really wary of, you know, overly broad restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to favor the economic benefits of free transfer.
That makes sense.
So the trial court initially sided with Mrs. Davis, but then the appellate court overturned it, saying, like, no way that ban on renting goes against public policy.
Interesting. So even with a life estate, unlimited power over the property isn't guaranteed.
Hmm.
What did the court say about WHY they struck down the rental ban? What public policy was at stake?
They emphasize that property should be freely transferable and usable, benefiting living owners.
Okay.
Basically, they said society thrives when wealth is usable, not locked in legal limbo.
Hmm. So even with property ownership, there are responsibilities.
Exactly. And sometimes those responsibilities outweigh individual desires.
That makes sense. This ruling has huge EE implications for the sharing economy today. Think about Airbnb restrictions in cities that's like echoes of Davis v. Davis, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Balancing owner rights with community impact.
Yeah.
It's a theme we see over and over again in the law.
Precisely. These cases highlight the tension between individual desires and the greater good. And that tension plays out in all sorts of legal arenas. It's really fascinating to see how the courts navigate those competing interests.
So let's recap for a second.
Okay.
We've got frozen embryos and beachfront property battles, both decided under the same name, Davis v. Davis.
Yeah.
On the surface, they seem totally different, but both are grappling with how far individual autonomy can actually go. Before we jump into the deeper legal stuff, any initial thoughts on what ties these seemingly disparate cases together?
What strikes me is the way both cases grapple with this, like, evolving definition of control in a changing world.
That's interesting.
Whether it's control over, you know, our genetic material or physical property, these cases force us to examine where individual rights end and societal interests begin. Welcome back, everyone. We just scratched the surface of these Davis v. Davis cases, exploring, you know, the drama of those frozen embryos and the beachfront property disputes.
Yeah, wild stuff.
But now let's, like, really unpack the legal reasoning that makes these cases so fascinating.
Okay, I'm ready. Let's go full-on law nerd here.
Yeah.
What were the courts really saying in these decisions, and why does it matter for, like, you know, for us today?
Okay, well, let's start with that frozen embryo case.
Right.
One of the most groundbreaking aspects of that case is the court's focus on procreational autonomy.
Okay.
They're essentially saying, look, people have this fundamental right to make choices about reproduction.
Uh-huh.
And that includes deciding to not become a parent.
Right.
Even if it means those embryos are never used.
Yeah, I can see how that sets a huge precedent, especially as reproductive technology keeps getting more advanced.
Right.
But I'm also thinking, like, what if Mary Sue had still wanted to use those embryos herself?
Mm-hmm.
Would the ruling have been different then?
Ah, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? The court was very careful to say that their decision was based on, you know, on this specific situation.
Okay.
So if Mary Sue was still trying to get pregnant, who knows how it would have played out?
Right. It's all hypothetical at that point.
It is. And it's a reminder that legal rulings are often very context specific.
It's true.
Even when they're tackling these huge EE concepts like procreational autonomy.
Okay. So even landmark cases leave some questions unanswered. But let's not forget about that property battle.
Right.
What legal principles were at work in that case?
Yeah.
It seemed like the court went out of its way to protect the kid's right to rent that property, even though Mrs. Davis technically had that life estate.
Right. And that gets to, like, the core of how courts balance individual property rights with broader societal interests. In that case, they were really concerned about, you know, the free flow of property.
Yeah.
They kept saying things like, you know, we don't want to clog up the system with a bunch of unreasonable restrictions.
So they're thinking big picture.
Right. It's like they're imagining this world where everyone's putting these, like, crazy limits on their property.
Yeah.
And then everything grinds to a halt.
Okay. So no one wants a legal logjam.
Yeah.
But what does alienation even mean in this context?
Right.
I feel like we're getting into, like, the weeds of property law here.
Yes, we are. Okay, so alienation just means transferring property, selling it, leasing it, inheriting it, all that stuff.
Okay.
A restraint on alienation is basically any rule that, you know, that makes it harder to do those things.
Okay.
Now, sometimes those restraints are okay. Like, think about historical preservation easements.
Right. Those exist for a reason.
Exactly. Right. But in Davis v. Davis, the court felt that blanket ban on renting just, like, went too far.
It's interesting how both these cases seem to, like, hinge on this idea of limits.
Yes.
Like, you know, you have rights, but those rights aren't absolute.
Exactly.
There's always this balance to strike.
That's such a great observation. Both Davis v. Davis cases really highlight how the law, you know, the law is constantly walking this tightrope between individual desires and what's, you know, what's best for society as a whole.
Yeah.
And honestly, as our world gets more and more complex, those lines are only going to get blurrier.
Okay, so we've got procreational autonomy on one side and then the free flow of property on the other.
Yeah.
It seems like pretty, you know, heady stuff. Mm-hmm. But what does it really mean for, like, lawyers and law students on, you know, like, on a practical level?
That's what makes it so exciting.
Okay, tell me more.
First, these cases are like a huge CE reminder to be super clear in legal agreements.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Whether you're drafting contracts for fertility treatments or, you know, hammering out the details of a property transfer, spelling everything out can prevent so many headaches down the road.
And probably lawsuits too, I'd bet.
Oh, absolutely. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, right?
For sure.
Especially when you're dealing with stuff as, you know, as emotionally charged as embryos or family property.
Exactly, yeah. What else?
Second, these cases show how the law is always evolving.
Okay.
New technologies, shifting social norms. The legal landscape is, like, never static.
Right.
So lawyers and law students, they need to be flexible, think critically, and be ready to, you know, apply old principles to these new situations.
So it's not just about knowing the rules, it's about understanding, like, why those rules even exist in the first place.
Exactly.
And how they might, like, flex in the future, right?
Yes, exactly. It's almost like being a legal detective.
I like that.
You got to be able to connect the dots, see the bigger picture, and then, like, anticipate how those dots might shift as the world changes around us. And that's what makes these Davis v. Davis cases so so valuable.
Yeah.
They offer this, like, glimpse into how the law adapts, how it balances those competing interests, and how it ultimately tries to create a just and functional society.
Wow. Okay. I'm feeling inspired to, like, hit the law books right now.
Huh?
But before we get too carried away, I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier.
Okay.
About how these cases highlight the evolving definition of control.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit more? I feel like that's like a huge EE concept that we're, you know, only beginning to grasp.
Absolutely. Think about it. Like, control over our bodies, control over our property, control over our data in this, like, digital age.
Uh-huh.
These are, like, fundamental concepts that the law has been grappling with for centuries.
That's true.
But as technology keeps advancing, those concepts are, you know, they're becoming more nuanced and more contested than ever before.
Right.
Davis v. Davis, in both of its forms, like, really forces us to confront these questions head on.
It's almost like we're redefining the boundaries of autonomy in real time.
Yes.
And that has to have major implications for how we think about everything from reproductive rights to property ownership in this, like, crazy 21st century.
You hit the nail on the head. These cases aren't just about embryos and beach houses. Mm. They're about, like, the fundamental principles that shape our legal system and ultimately our society.
Yeah.
And those principles are constantly being tested and refined as we navigate this, like, complex and rapidly changing world.
Okay, my mind is officially blown.
Uh-huh.
We've gone from frozen embryos to property rights to, like, the very definition of control in the digital age.
Yeah.
I think we need a minute to, like, process all this.
Okay.
Before we jump into, you know, the final takeaways.
Sounds good.
Okay, so we're back, and my brain is still buzzing from that last segment. It's amazing how two cases, both called Davis v. Davis,
right,
can open up so many questions about, you know, individual rights and societal good and the future of control.
Yeah, especially in a world that's, like, changing so fast.
Seriously. It's a testament to, like, the power of the law to grapple with these really complex issues, even when, you know, the answers aren't always super clear.
Yeah, and as we keep moving further into the 21st century, I think these kinds of questions are only going to get, like, more and more pressing.
So let's try to bring it all home. What are the biggest takeaways from these Davis v. Davis cases?
Mm-hmm.
Not just for, you know, for lawyers, but for, like, anyone trying to make sense of the world.
Well, the first takeaway that jumps out at me is the importance of informed consent.
Okay.
Especially as, you know, as technology gives us more choices and more control over our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's fertility treatment or genetic testing or even just agreeing to the terms of service for some new app, you know.
Right.
We need to be aware of the potential consequences of our decisions.
That's a great point. Mm. It's so easy to just click agree without really thinking about, like, what we're actually signing away.
Right.
These cases remind us that those decisions, they can have long-term implications.
Absolutely.
Especially when it comes to, you know, something as personal as our reproductive choices or our property rights.
Exactly. And that brings us to the second big takeaway. The limits of individual autonomy.
Mm.
We live in a society, And that means that sometimes our desires have to be balanced against the needs of the community.
Yeah.
Even if those needs seem, you know, kind of abstract or far-reaching,
okay.
The Davis v. Davis cases, they show us how the law tries to strike that balance.
Yeah.
And sometimes in ways that feel, you know, surprising or even unfair.
I'm thinking back to that property case.
Yeah.
How the court basically said, like, you can't just lock up this valuable property and prevent other people from using it.
Right.
Makes me wonder, like, what other kinds of restrictions might courts strike down in the future?
Mm.
Could there be, like, a Davis v. Davis case about digital assets or intellectual property?
That's such a good question.
Right.
And it's exactly the kind of, like, forward-thinking analysis that, you know, lawyers and law students need to be doing.
Yeah.
The principles that we see in Davis v. Davis balancing individual rights with the societal good, you know, defining the boundaries of control. These are concepts that will continue to shape these legal debates as technology, you know, as technology keeps reshaping the world around us.
Okay, I'm officially adding future law predictor to my resume.
Uh-huh.
But before we get too far ahead of ourselves, is there anything else we can learn from these cases?
Yeah.
Especially for, like, you know, folks who might be facing similar legal challenges in their own lives.
I'm so glad you asked that.
Yeah.
Here's the bottom line. If you're ever in doubt, talk to a lawyer.
Okay, good advice.
Whether you're, you know, whether you're thinking about fertility treatments or entering into a property agreement or just navigating any kind of complex legal situation, having that expert guidance can make a world of difference.
That's true.
A good lawyer can help you understand your rights, anticipate potential pitfalls, and really advocate for your best interests.
It's like having a legal Sherpa.
Right.
Guiding you through all the treacherous mountain passes of the legal system.
Uh-huh. Exactly.
And honestly, sometimes those passes can feel pretty treacherous even for lawyers.
You said it. The law is complex. It's constantly evolving, but that's also what makes it so fascinating.
Yeah, I agree.
These Davis v. Davis cases, they're just this tiny glimpse into the, you know, this vast and ever-changing landscape of legal thought.
It's true.
They challenge us to, you know, they challenge us to think critically, question assumptions, and really engage in this thoughtful debate about the values that shape our society as a whole.
Wow, what a journey this has been.
I know, right?
From frozen embryos to beach house battles to, like, the future of control in this digital world. I feel like we barely scratched the surface, but, you know, in a good way.
I totally agree. And that's the beauty of the law, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's always more to learn. There's always more to explore. There's always more to debate.
Absolutely.
And as long as we stay curious and engaged, we'll keep uncovering these new insights and we'll be able to grapple with those complex challenges that, you know, that lie ahead.
Well said. To all of our listeners out there, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the fascinating world of Davis v. Davis. We hope you've learned something new, maybe challenged some of your assumptions, and, you know, maybe even sparked a few legal debates of your own.
And until next time, keep those legal minds sharp and keep those conversations flowing.